Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide, and today on The Wire.
Just take one step to tell someone you trust, call a helpline, see your doctor, and also to those around someone who could be struggling, just to say it does make a difference if you let people know you are you okay?
Asking for help and checking in with friends and colleagues can make a real difference on suicide prevention. And
we're a community and we need to be looking at the needs of Aboriginal people in as part of our community, as part of our legal system and our justice system.
Draft Aboriginal Justice Agreement released today in the NT. Also today, more mental health support needed for children in war zones. And a damning report outlines the experiences of discrimination by Asian Australians. Stay tuned for the next half hour. Are you okay? It's a question we should be asking each other more often. Do you know someone suffering from mental health issues? The answer is probably yes. Rates of depression and suicide have been skyrocketing over the past decade. Today is the 11th Are You Okay Day in Australia, a national awareness day focusing on suicide prevention by opening up conversations around mental health. Graham Cowan is the co-founder of Are You Okay Foundation. He spoke to The Wire's Heloise Vias about the theme, trust the signs, trust your gut and ask if you're okay.
Looking out for our friends, looking out for our mates and just being able to observe the things that might change. Like people could be isolating more, they could not be coming to regular events, be less reliable. And what we're encouraging people to do is not just to ignore it, just ask, are you okay? Because that can make a real difference. It can provide that emotional support and encourage people to seek help.
What do suicide rates look like in Australia?
We lose about 3,000 people per year to suicide. So that's 240 people attempting to take their life each day. It's a huge issue. And of course, it's not just those people, but it's the family, the friends that are around those people that are also profoundly affected. We don't need to be counsellors. We don't need to be doctors to help. Just having that simple conversation, providing that emotional support can be profoundly important.
And it's just heartbreaking to see so many people take their lives because they don't have anyone to talk to. Do you think more services are needed?
We need to be more flexible in the resourcing that we look at. In country areas, rural areas, for example, it's very, very hard to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, if at all. And so we need to look at more creative ways of getting that support services out. It is starting, but it's got a long way to go.
How is Are You Okay creating a conversation or awareness within the community? What exactly are the kind of services that are offered?
We list all the resources out there. So places like Lifeline, Suicide Callback Service, Men's Line, Beyond Blue, they're all listed on the Get Help section on the Are You Okay website. Our role is to start the conversation, encourage people to seek help, and then to check in and follow up and see if they've actually done it. Firsthand, I've been through really bad depression for myself. I've attempted suicide myself. And I just know how important it is to have that emotional support, people that genuinely care for you to reach out.
You also shared your suicide note publicly. How has that been received?
I've been overwhelmed by the response, but I decided to just share it on there just as a beacon of hope. And I knew that there would be people that would see it, that would feel suicidal. And so my message was, just take one step to tell someone you trust, call a helpline, see your doctor. And also for those around someone who could be struggling, just to say, it does make a difference if you let people know you are, ask, are you okay? But it went viral. It's had 60,000 comments and views from around the world. And everyone's just saying this is a really important conversation to have and we need to not pretend it doesn't happen and have a cone of silence. We need to be really proactive, honest and authentic about it.
Graham Cowan, co-founder of the Are You OK Foundation, speaking to The Wire's Heloise Vias. You're listening to The Wire. The the NT government has released a draft proposal aiming to reduce the rates of incarceration and recidivism of Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander people. The Aboriginal Justice Agreement outlines what needs to be improved in reforming the criminal justice system, including the reintroduction of community courts, where Aboriginal elders preside with magistrates to ensure Indigenous law is taken into account when sentencing offenders. David Woodroof is the Principal Legal Officer for the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency. He told The Wire's Jared McLaughlin why an Aboriginal Justice Agreement is a positive move.
For the very first time in Northern Territory, we've actually had a government intention that's to create an Aboriginal Justice Agreement that has made their strong commitment to lower the incarceration rate of Aboriginal people and the recidivism rate of Aboriginal people returning to jail. But this really is about transforming completely that landscape of the justice system for Aboriginal people and making it a system that can work for Aboriginal people, but actually working in such a way to lower those incarceration rates and, importantly, to keep people out of jail and building up our communities.
This actually came from a very rigorous, extensive consultation process, which was done over 2 years. What were some of the recommendations that were put forward to the government?
You're very right. It was a very important part of this process, of this draft Aboriginal Justice Agreement, of going and listening to Aboriginal people throughout the communities in the Northern Territory, in the prison system, but also having a very rigorous examination of the justice system and the inclusion of obtaining data and experts about that justice system. The very important message that's been heard very loud and clear, and that is a central part of this draft Aboriginal Justice Agreement, voices from the community, is about not losing those members of their community to end up in prison and be taken away from their communities and ending up in lives caught up in the justice system and the prison system and wasted life. And very importantly, that's this very strong message that we heard from people in prison about wanting their younger brothers and sisters and community members not to lead a life that leads to crime and imprisonment.
One of the proposals that was put to the government included reintroducing community courts. Do you think that that is a good way to try and reduce the number of Indigenous people who are incarcerated in the prison system?
Absolutely, Jared. Look, I'm very honoured and proud to have been a lawyer previously in the Northern Territory, where about 15 years ago there were community courts, and actually being involved in that process were a courts where there are a number of elders are involved in that process. It is absolutely fantastic. It brings in what's really needed in sentencing. It brings in that community view, brings in the views of the elders, and it's very powerful because elders will know that young person, the person who's offending, they'll know their family, they'll know their grandparents, and it has a very powerful effect in, you know, the importance around shame, responsibility, but also it brings in that personal experience. If someone's broken into a community store, these are the people who have also been affected, members of your community, but also they're there to play a very important thing about teaching. And teaching, not just for that young person, to the person who's offended, but teaching to the court, to the lawyers, to the prosecutors, to the judges, to the victim, about this person, who they are and how they fit in the community.
Do you think that this could help to improve or even to change attitudes towards Indigenous people, including Aboriginal Territorians, to making the criminal justice system less racially intolerant?
All the community, Aboriginal community, non-Aboriginal community, want to see greater impact of the court system that makes a meaningful difference in people's lives, so that with the stopping of that imprisonment, that is the stopping of reoffending, it is about making safer and better communities and making people have different opportunities in their lives. So I really do see that there will be community support that shows that there is the need for an Aboriginal Justice Agreement. There is the need for doing things differently, because we know presently that the system, not just the justice system, not just in crime, but in many different aspects of people, Aboriginal people encounter in the legal system, they encounter many barriers. And some of those barriers are very simple barriers, which would shock people. I can think of an example of Triple O calls. So with Triple O calls, if a person rings up and they speak a foreign language from another country, AAAO's system allows for 54 interpreters of different languages. But in the Northern Territory, there are no Aboriginal languages as a AAAO call. These are fundamental sort of questions. An Aboriginal person calling up for help should be understood in any language. You know, we're a community, and we need to be looking at the needs of Aboriginal people in as part of our community, but part of our legal system and our justice system, where there are these barriers. And importantly, where there are barriers where people can't access programs in prisons because there are no interpreters.
David Woodroof, Principal Legal Officer for the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency, ending that story with The Wire's Jared McLaughlin.
You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs from all over Australia.
An Iranian woman has died after setting herself alight in front of a Tehran courthouse in protest of Iran's stadium ban. Sahar Kadouri was arrested and jailed for 3 days in March for trying to enter a football stadium, a place where women are regularly barred from entering. Her death has spurred calls from FIFA, the world's governing football body, to take action. The Wire's Georgia Gina McKay spoke to Richard Brunoski, former diplomat and former president of the Australian Institute of National Affairs, about Iran's history with women's rights and whether FIFA could interject.
It's a cohesive country. The Iranians are proud people. They're not going to be shoved around. They have Europe on side. They have Russia, China as their allies at present against Trump, who's trying to conflict all sorts of problems for them. I am optimistic that there will be some kind of negotiations, and the FIFA ban will, if it happens, will be all part of the negotiations. I think we just have to wait to see.
The ban's not written into law, so how can women be arrested and trialled for entering stadiums in this instance?
That's because of the moral police. They tend to be inconsistent in the way they enforce. The fact it's not written into law doesn't mean it won't be enforced by some moral police who take it upon themselves to be more rigorous than others do. It's an uncertain situation. I like to think that in Iran, where I visited only a year ago, is becoming more and more flexible, certainly more than Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries. It's very uncertain. It must be very trying for women who wish to be more flexible and have the same freedoms as men, see the way their freedoms can be curtailed at the whim of moral police without any moral code has been written into any document.
In that case, is it common for the police in that area to take the law into their own hands at times?
It would be. In some centres like Qom, I think moral police are much more strict than they are in Tehran or other countries. It must be very trying for women to have some consistent behaviour on the part of their so-called moral guardians.
So his sister reportedly told an Iranian outlet that her sister suffered from bipolar disorder and her time in jail made her condition worse. Is the Iranian legal system efficient in dealing with people with mental illnesses?
Certainly not. Some men can be compassionate and give more flexibility to the way justice is handled. Others don't. It's very trying for women involved.
FIFA have already come out in disagreement of the ban. Do you think there's more FIFA could be doing?
Not really. Iran is a sovereign country. They're under enough pressure from the United States right now. They're not going to be persuaded by further pressure.
Could FIFA banning the Iranian Football Federation from participating in the World Cup be any help?
Oh, yes, that could work. If they do that, there'll be a huge reaction. Let's hope they go ahead and do that and see what happens.
Do you think we'll see the ban be lifted permanently in the near future?
One can only speculate. I hope so. It would be a wonderful thing if that happened. It's a powder keg, the whole situation. I just hope that the Iranians see reason and do lift the ban so that FIFA doesn't have to ban them from soccer.
Richard Brunoski, former diplomat and former president of the Australian Institute of National Affairs, speaking there to The Wire's Georgina McKay. Over 7 million children in war zones across the world are at risk of developing mental health problems due to a few available resources. Save the Children recently released a report called Road to Recovery that discusses these issues. They've urged Australia to increase funding for mental health support services for children living in conflict. Nadine Haddad is a senior humanitarian advisor at Save the Children and was involved in the research. The Wire's Heloise Vias asked her about her findings.
More than 7 million children living in conflict zones are at serious risk of developing severe mental health disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and severe post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also 24 million children, and that is four times the child population of Australia, if you want to put things in perspective, that require some form of mental health support, whether now or in the future. And what this report shows that despite this massive scale of the crisis, funding that goes to programs addressing children's mental health are very inadequate at best.
Is Australia currently providing any support services at all for children living in conflict?
There is no specific or systemized approach to incorporating mental health into programs. So while there are really good examples where the government of Australia have provided funding, Bangladesh for the Rohingya response being one, where the government of Australia supported funding health facilities across Cox's Bazar camp. And within that budget, there was an allocation to have counsellors to address the mental health issues. But there's no systematic approach. The figures of this report shows that this is a problem at a large scale.
Having said that, how do these children deal with their trauma when they have no one to talk to?
I've seen amazing things that children can do. The resilience, their ability to bounce back is amazing. What they need is be provided with a safe place, so remove the threat and be provided with programs that support them. We activate community social networks. And by that, I mean, you know, we invest in schools or safe spaces that we call child-friendly spaces or youth-friendly spaces. And these are the spaces where we have programs, you know, therapeutic programs that addresses the emotional and mental health needs. So one of my favorite ones is what we call the HEARTS, and this is the Healing and Education Through Arts. And this is a platform where children can express their emotion or process. And what we have seen is the incredible resilience of children to bounce back from the terrors and the violence that they have seen. Having said that, there are children under extreme stress may show a range of mental health and psychosocial problems. So while the majority of children can benefit from these community level networks, others require more specialized services. So this is where we would need, you know, basic healthcare support where they can access non-medical counseling if they need. But then there's also, you know, the very minority of children who would require medical intervention where they would need to be cared by a psychiatric nurse or doctors. And this is where this report shows that 7 million children around the world would require that assistance, and that assistance is not available in these war zones.
Obviously, recently conversations around mental health are coming more to the forefront, but it seems like the focus is more general. And do you think non-profits and government aid should be focused more towards minorities, and in this case, children affected in war zones?
Absolutely. There is a need for donors like Australia and others to do more when it comes to mental health and psychosocial needs of children living in conflict zones. What we know is that children of minority groups or children who already have disability or, you know, are from a diverse backgrounds or ethnicity, if they are suffering from mental health or psychosocial issues, they would be even less likely to access support. One clear example is how this affects boys and girls differently. We see that gender plays a big part. We work in communities where gender norms already are disadvantaged to girls, so we see a lot of gender-based violence targeted towards girls. Not saying that boys are not do not face them, but if they do face them, then boys are even less likely to access help. So what we're saying is that there are different levels of mental health and psychosocial support that needs to be addressed. While we can support the majority of children facing mild and moderate mental health issues, and we can do that through funding programs like education and protection, this is where we're able to reach mass numbers of children. But then we need to build on that and target those who need more specialized support services. So absolutely, we should be doing more. And what we're calling for is that mental health and psychosocial support to be a priority or a consideration across all humanitarian response and programs, especially in education.
Nadine Haddad, Senior Humanitarian Advisor at Save the Children, speaking to The Wire's Heloise Vyas. If this or any other story on today's program has raised concerns for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or visit beyondblue.org.au, where you can find a list of national helplines and websites. Have you ever been treated differently because of your cultural background? According to a new study released this week, over 80% of Asian Australians have been discriminated against. Researchers from the Australian National University's Centre for Social Research and Methods surveyed Asian Australians about their experiences in various settings, including workplaces, schools, government departments, and more. Over 70% reported they experienced discrimination at a shop or restaurant, and 65% said they have been discriminated against in the workplace. Jay Yung Lo is one of the authors of the study. He told me, The Wire's Catherine Andrews, that within these statistics, Chinese Australians are most discriminated against.
We've experienced a history of discrimination and racism since the first arrival of Chinese migrants to Australia. In fact, the infamous White Australia policy, which was a policy to discourage migrants from Asia and other parts of the world that are deemed as non-European or Western. And Chinese Australians, despite the fact that they've contributed so much to Australia's development for over 200 years, they still felt a large experience of being discriminated against for who they are. But unfortunately, we've also seen new forms of discrimination creeping up for Asian Australians, but particularly Chinese Australians, due to the debate around foreign interference.
Have you ever experienced discrimination yourself in the workplace?
I have experienced more like cultural stereotyping rather than racism. There was a situation where I was a newly elected local government councillor for a suburban council here in Melbourne, and a couple of months later I attended a local government conference here in Melbourne, and I walked into the conference room, sort of open space where they were sort of providing catering and coffee and tea breaks, walked into the room and there was a very elderly councillor from a rural city in Victoria came up and asked me to get him a cup of coffee. So I think from my experience, I haven't received in-your-face blatant racism and discrimination in the workplace, but I have experienced cultural stereotyping and subtle racism. And also, I guess, being someone who's an Australian of Chinese heritage, my name is also a bit of a dead giveaway in terms of, you know, whether I'm able to speak English or not. So usually I spend at least 6 or 7 times a day spelling out my name to people over the phone, and also, you know, answering questions when people say, oh, you speak very good English, you know. And these aren't people in the workplace. It's more sort of people that I've come across in the community who I sort of deal with as stakeholders. And, yeah, so I guess, you know, more cultural stereotyping rather than racism.
In the report, 65% of Asian Australians reported being discriminated against in the workplace. What can be done to stop that kind of behaviour?
What we really need to see is for senior leaders and decision makers within the workplace to step up, to actually embrace and recognise the different types of skills brought forward by Asian Australians. Leaders and workplaces themselves need to diversify their views of leadership in terms of what leadership looks like, and that leadership comes in a variety of different forms, not just the loudest person in the room that has the most leadership potential. So, you know, there are different forms of leadership that needs to be recognised. But also, you know, we need more champions to come out and actually push for better representation and recognition of Asian Australians and their skills and their contribution to Australia. We need this topic to be discussed more openly, more publicly, and also I think workplaces themselves need to start valuing what Asian Australians can bring to their teams. And, you know, there's plenty of research that looks at that, especially from McKinsey and Company, where they said that if a company embraces ethnic diversity, there's a 35% chance more of being more profitable and more successful. So, you know, the numbers are there, the figures are there, the research is there. We just need leaders to step up and take initiative.
Do you think there needs to be more policies put into place to allow more Asian Australians to step up into more senior leadership positions at workplaces?
Absolutely. I think there needs to be more initiatives, policies, targets, objectives, commitments by leaders and workplaces and various industries and sectors to encourage more Asian Australians to serve in leadership positions, whether it be training programs, whether it be highlighting the achievements of Asian Australians within their workplace, whether it's talking about the issue generally. I think there is definitely a need for more policies and strategies developed to support more Asian Australians to serve in leadership positions.
Jay Yung Lo, speaking with the Wire's Catherine Andrews ahead of the first Asian Australian Leadership Summit happening today and Friday in Melbourne. And that's it for The Wire today. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide, and I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for your company. We'll be right back.